You're listening to Something Wicked Radio. This week, Kelly Knoll. That's Bradley Knoll's sister from Sublime. This is season 20, episode 7.
Things I do to keep you close to me, and every day's another day from what we used to be. And I don't know what I've been thinking, cause this is much like hell. It's days like this, I must insist I'm not doing so well. Oh no, get lost in you, like you know I often do. And I wonder if you're proud of me, can hear me shout at me. I need to kill this doubt at me for good. So help me now to let you go. Think about these last 10 years and what they've done to me. And I don't think it's worth it, cause it's just not fun to me. What if I just killed myself and never spoke again? Could you make your way back through the darkness and meet me at the end? Oh no, get lost in you, like you know I often do. And I wonder if you're proud of me, if you can hear me shout at me. I need to kill this doubt at me for good. So help me now to let you go, so I can live, so I can me now to let you go. So help me now to let you go. So help me now to let you go. So I can live, ayo. So I can live, ayo. So I can live, ayo. So I can live.
Kelly?
Hi, Kelly. This is Julia Hollingsworth calling from Something Wicked Radio. Hi, how are you
it's
doing this
Malibu,
evening?
Malibu, California. I'm like, how did Julia get to Malibu already?
Malibu. Okay, I was wondering what showed up. I never know what number is going to be there. So how
That's
are you doing
funny.
This
are
evening?
I'm really good, actually. I'm doing great. Thank you for asking. How about you?
I'm doing great. You ready to start this show?
Yes. All right. Let's do this.
Let's do this. First off, what's the name of your foundation?
It's the Knoll Family Foundation, and we're working right now to raise money to open Bradley's House in honor of my brother Brad.
And what is Bradley's House?
Bradley's House will be a 6-bed treatment facility for people in the music industry who are struggling with opioid addiction. And the idea is to be able to offer the services for whatever financial support somebody has, if they do or if they don't, but we don't want to ever turn anybody away. So that's the whole point of having it be a nonprofit and raising the funds. We want to have enough money that if everybody who comes to us has no means of financial support whatsoever, we can still provide the services. And it'll be a 1-week medical detox in a medical facility, and then a 90-day program with us, and then we'll help them transition into a sober living.
How long has the foundation been open?
We started the foundation just over 2 years ago. It was when my nephew, Jacob, Brad's son, was in rehab, and he was working with an old friend of my brother's, Todd Balkins, who'd been his sober coach for a while. And Todd had had this idea, and he approached my dad with it, and he thought it was a fabulous idea. And then he talked to me about it, and I thought it was wonderful. I started bawling immediately. I'm a crier. And I just thought it was such a great way to honor Brad's memory, to help other people, other families, avoid the tragedy of what we went through, and provide some hope and healing is really what it's all about. And the cool thing is that in the process, of course, it's provided a lot of healing for my family as well. So I feel really fortunate in that regard.
Right on. Can you tell people how to get in touch with your foundation if they want to donate?
We have a website. Our website is thenoelfamilyfoundation.org. We also have a Facebook page. We're Noel Foundation on Facebook. We're Noel Family on Instagram and Twitter. So there's lots of ways to reach us.
When do you think it'll be open?
If it were up to me, it would be open tomorrow. I really feel the sense of urgency that every day that we delay, there's one more person that we could have helped, one more person that we could have given hope to, one more person that we could have lifted up. So I really feel a burden to help people. And the longer it takes, the more difficult it is to keep that momentum going. So I'm excited that we've got some fabulous things coming up that are really going to help to bring the funds in. And I'm hoping that we can get the money together that we need within the next year to be able to open the house. That's my goal.
What are the events?
We have a benefit show coming up next month. It's a small local show, but it definitely helps to raise awareness and get the word out. And we've been doing some local things, some music festivals, that kind of thing, that's really helped to get the word out. We have a lot of great musician friends across the country that are starting to take some of our merch with them on tour and sell the merch on tour. That helps to get the word out. And then just within the last couple of weeks, we had this really exciting thing happen. We were contacted by Law Records, which is a label owned by the guys from Pepper. And their general manager, Paul Milbury, reached out to us and said they had this idea to do a compilation album of Sublime acoustic covers by a bunch of different artists. And all the money, all the proceeds would go to the foundation. And just within the last 2 weeks, I think like 15, 20 different artists have agreed to do a song for the album, and we're still reaching out to more. So there's a possibility we may do a couple different volumes. It could turn into a potential show somewhere down the road. There's just so many things that could happen from it, but I'm really excited about this because our goal right from the start was not just for, it wasn't about us making this happen. It was about us using the connections that we have, just reaching out to people within the music community, within the Sublime community, who together we can all make it happen. And that's what I feel like this is really doing for the first time, is really kind of bringing everybody's strength together to make something happen. But we've been so fortunate ever since we started. I mean, within 6 months of when we started, I was contacted by a good friend of mine, Casey Sullivan, who's a local musician, and he's said, you know, I'd like to pull some of my musician friends together and we'll do a show and we'll play a bunch of Sublime songs and donate the proceeds to the foundation. Would that be okay? I'm like, yeah, Casey, that would be awesome. So he did, and they formed a band called Burritos. They play Sublime covers, and through the last year and a half have really just created so much momentum and excitement about what we're doing. And that's been the most amazing thing as far as getting the word out and bringing visibility to the cause. So we really have a lot of great people that have put in time and effort, and it's really humbling to me because they do it out of their desire to want to help other people, their desire to honor my brother's memory, and their desire to make a difference because everybody knows somebody who's been impacted by addiction.
How old was he when he first became addicted?
Well, that's a good question. He struggled with heroin for 4 years before it took his life. So he was about 24, somewhere around there when he tried it for the first time. But he had been struggling with addiction prior to that, and other things. And for him, it really was a progressive disease. It was something that he felt like, you know, he could control, but eventually it controlled him. And we do have a history of addiction in our family, and those things definitely are hereditary. But he just happened to be in the right environment that made it exceptionally difficult for him to get clean and stay clean.
How did his addiction affect your family?
Oh, wow. That's a difficult question. It was when Brad first was using heroin, it was definitely something that we could see a difference in the way that he behaved, but it was still very isolated to just impacting him personally. And as the weeks and months and years progressed, it became something that impacted everyone, all, you know, his close friends, his immediate family, because he began to prioritize the drug over the people that he loved. And that's when addiction gets extremely heartbreaking for the people around the addict. There were times when, you know, he would steal things so that he could get a fix. He would pawn his equipment knowing that their manager would go and buy it all back before a show. He wasn't fun to be around. He physically, you could see a huge difference in him. I've always been amused by people who comment on the way that Brad looks in pictures. You know, if he was clean, he was healthy, and he would put on more weight. To me, that's clean Brad, that's healthy Brad, that's the real Brad. Then when he would be strung out, he would get really, really gaunt, sickly looking, in my opinion. And so I associate that, you know, that look, of course, with the really difficult and traumatic times of his addiction. And so it's funny, people online will refer to Fat Brad and Skinny Brad. I loved Fat Brad because that was healthy Brad, that was clean Brad, that was the Brad that was the Brad I knew.
What was it like growing up with him?
It was lots of crazy things. It was sometimes wonderful. It was sometimes awful. He was very animated and extreme in a lot of things. But he was the closest thing that I had, that really, I really depended on him a lot. He was 2.5 years older than me, and I was a late talker because he would do all my talking for me. I didn't really start talking until he went with my grandfather over to Hawaii to visit family. And I'm told that I started talking just like in these more complete sentences than you would expect a small child to, because prior to that, if I needed something, I would make a sound and he would tell my parents, oh, she's tired, no, she's hungry, oh, she's thirsty. And then he taught me to read. I looked up to him so much. He was my, you know, constant companion when I was younger, and I'm sure most girls look up to their big brothers, but to me, he was everything for so long. There was a lot of craziness in our childhood growing up. So for me, he was the constant. He was the one thing that I knew I could always depend on. So when I lost him, it was incredibly difficult because I felt like I lost everything that I knew was certain. You know, it's hard to imagine, even still. Been over 23 years, and it's still hard to imagine a life without him, a life where my kids don't know him, where he's not a part of, you know, the exciting things that are happening and the sad things that are happening. It's still difficult for me to adjust to sometimes.
When was the moment you realized Sublime had made it?
It definitely wasn't until after he died, that's for sure. Maybe when they were, no, I'll tell you. I know one time that it's kind of weird, but this was, for me, was huge. When we were younger, we always listened to music. It was just a thing. I just figured everybody grew up that way, but there was always music around the house. And we always listened to music. And we went to a summer camp in Utah for a few years. And I remember the first summer that I was old enough to go. And it seemed like all summer long, we listened to Pat Benatar, like everybody. Just that was the thing. It was like the late 70s, and it was all about Pat Benatar. And so I grew up loving Pat Benatar, and I remember one time after Brad had died, and I couldn't even tell you exactly when it was, but it was probably a year or so after he died. I was watching something on TV, some interview that Pat Benatar was doing, and someone was asking her about the music that her kids listened to, and she said Sublime, and I was completely floored. Like, for me to have somebody that Brad and I listened to that seemed so completely on another level, completely inaccessible, completely removed from our life, to even speak the word of their band, to me was huge. It was, and I think to me that was really a moment when I was like, wait, what? How has she heard of Sublime? She's not from Long Beach. Like, I don't know. That just, to me, that was a huge moment. There was also, prior to that, when he was still alive, at the K-Rock Weenie Roast. I think it was like 1995, I want to say. And Date Rape had been getting a lot of airplay. And so I went to the Weenie Roast, and I always like to watch from the audience to be a part of, you know, everyone around, feeling the energy, the music and all that. So I was out in the audience watching, and they were playing, and they started playing Date Rape, and everybody around me started singing along. And I had been to a bunch of shows, and there were people that knew the music, but to be in that size of a crowd in a venue that I'd grown up going to shows at, and have what felt like everybody around me singing his lyrics, totally tripped me out. I don't think that was as big of a moment as the Pat Benatar interview, but it definitely was a moment to me that was like, wait a minute, there's people that I don't know, that I've never met, that I'll probably never even talk to, that know his lyrics. That was a real trip for me.
How old were you when he died?
I was 25.
How'd you hear about it?
I had been out, and I came home, and I got out of my, pulled into the garage, and I got out of my car, and my husband came and met me at in the garage, and he told me that Brad had died. He had gotten the call. I'm not sure who called him, but my mom was over there, and then we all went up to my dad's house, and yeah, that was the moment. That was a difficult moment. I don't remember exactly the words he said. It was something that, quite honestly, I mean, for a couple of years, we had all sort of, I think, worried about losing him because he had been in and out of rehab and struggling. But at that moment, he was at such a good place. He had just gotten married 7 days before, and he was clean, and Jacob was 11 months old, and there was just this sense of everything is okay right now. It was super, super unexpected, and everything within me just rejected the fact that he was gone, that it was so final, that there was no way to get him back. That was very difficult. I just remember just collapsing. I just completely collapsed, and my husband got me, and it just felt like everything completely shattered in my universe. I'm sure, you know, we all lose people, and anyone who has lost someone close to them in a very unexpected way, I'm sure, goes through the same kind of thing. I don't think my experience is unique in any way, but it really rocked my world.
I imagine. So can I ask you, switching gears here, what do you do for a living?
I do a lot of things for a living. I've been divorced for about 5.5 years, so I do whatever I can to make ends meet. I've been editing books for a long time. Mostly I did it for favors for people for, I don't know, over 25 years or something. So when I got divorced, I was still homeschooling my kids, and I needed work that I could do from home while they were sleeping. So I would homeschool them during the day, and I would work at night. So I just, all of a sudden people would be like, hey, can you do this? Or can you do this? And I just never said no to anything. I think the beauty of technology these days is anybody can learn how to do anything. So someone would say, do you know how to do this? And I'd say, sure. And then I'd go Google it and spend a few hours learning how to do it. And so I started bookkeeping. I had a little bit of experience in bookkeeping prior to that. And I'd run a business before, a small business. But I started bookkeeping and editing books and editing newspaper articles and making websites, doing newsletters, doing lots of secretarial work. That was what I had done prior to being married, just to pay the bills. And so just anything that I could. And I was really, really blessed that people would refer me to somebody else, and then someone would call me and say, hey, so-and-so said that you're the one to do this. And I'd be like, yes, I can do that. And I'd go figure out how to do it. So I, you know, learned different software, whatever it was that I needed to be able to do it. And now I actually am, I still have some freelance clients, and I also work full-time as a bookkeeper and human resources, and I run the foundation.
What would you like to be doing?
God, that's a great question. Honestly, I don't know. I was married for 23 years, and when that ended, I really just did not know what to do with my life other than keep taking care of my kids. My oldest is a senior in college. My youngest is a junior in high school. So I feel like I have a little more time to try to figure out what I want to do when I grow up. But I'm kind of just going where my path takes me. I just keep my feet moving, and things seem to happen, doors open, and I just walk down the next path and see what happens. And it's really unusual and scary for me, because I was always a planner. I always knew what I wanted to do. I had a plan. I was very career focused until I got married, and then I was very family focused. So it's just been a real time of self-discovery for me, and I'm really not even sure what I want to do when I grow up, but I'm 49, so I figure I better figure it out pretty soon.
So is there anyone you'd like to give a shout out to?
Oh, you know, I feel like if I start giving shout outs, I'm going to end up kicking myself all night long for the people that I forgot. I do have to say that, because when we started the foundation, it's such a personal thing, you know, like we're doing this to help other people, but my family's name is on the letterhead, and I feel a huge sense of responsibility for that. So anybody who reaches out to me and says, you know, hey, let me help, or hey, what can I do to help with this? I feel such an overwhelming sense of gratitude, because they're not only helping this cause, but, you know, they're furthering this mission that we have as a family. And to me, they're saying, you know, I want to be a part of this. I want to be a part of what you're doing. So I feel like everybody who this far has been a part of this journey is a part of our extended family now. And, you know, like I mentioned Casey Sullivan earlier, he was such a huge part of getting things going and getting things off the ground. And so now he's a board member, and we're super stoked to have him on the board. And his brother Tyson has been an amazing help. He works in the recovery industry, and so now he's on the board. And I met this wonderful woman, Brindy Conwell. Her husband is in a band called Roots of Mine, and they played at one of our benefit shows last year. And she approached me and said, hey, if there's ever anything I can do to help, let me know. And, you know, right now we just need money. So I don't really know what to tell people when they say, you know, let me know what I can do to help. But she just kept being persistent and saying, hey, can I help? Hey, can I help? And we had a show coming up down in San Diego, which is about an hour and a half away from where I live. And so I was going to be down there running the merch table all by myself. And she said, hey, I'm going to come down to the show. Can I help you out? I'm like, yeah, actually, that would be really great. And that was about a year ago, just over a year ago. And ever since then, I absolutely don't know what I would have done without her. She comes to every single show. She even is at shows that I can't be at. She represents the foundation. She helps us out with the merchandise. And she does such an amazing job at something that is hard for me, trying to, you know, manage making the sales and then talk with people and share the message of the foundation and all that. So she's been instrumental. So she's on our board now. And of course, Todd Dawkins, who was the one who came up with the whole idea, our co-founder, is on our board, and he's an amazing force of nature. And then we've been super fortunate to add two new board members in the last couple of months. Wes Gear, he's a musician, and he has an amazing nonprofit organization called Rock to Recovery that takes these music programs into different rehab programs to allow music to be part of people's recovery. And it's really phenomenal, the things that they're doing. I'm so excited about what he's doing with Rock to Recovery, and then super stoked to have his knowledge brought, you know, to the table to help Bradley's House and the Knoll Family Foundation. And also Ken Denson, who's a tour manager. He's been a tour manager for Gwen Stefani and Brian Setzer, and right now he works with REO Speedwagon, and he has so much knowledge about the music industry and you know, how to reach people and how to make things happen, and he's a huge Sublime fan, and so I feel super, super stoked to have him on board as well. So, and then also my dad is on the board. He's the chairman of the board. My stepmom, Janie, and my nephew, Jacob. So we have such a great group of people. But then there's always people that are, you know, doing amazing things for us, like Paul Milbury and the guys from Pepper who are making this album happen. And like I said, I really should stop with the names, because I'll spend the rest of tonight after we end this interview thinking of all the people that I forgot that I should have mentioned. I'm really, really humbled, and I don't say that lightly, but truly humbled by all the help and support that we've received from people. It's really, really awesome. I think Brad would be super stoked by it, too.
What is your advice for someone who wants to start a foundation?
Have a passion. Have a clear mission. It has to be something that you are completely, completely dedicated to, that you'll do whether it kills you or not, because there have been times in the past over the last couple of years, and I'm sure there will be more times in the future, where I felt like it was you know, pushing a train uphill, and that it was too much. It's been very overwhelming at times, because it's a lot of work. It really is, and it's difficult trying to get people to, you know, trust that what you're doing is the right thing, and, you know, to give money and to give time and to give trust. It's a hard thing, and there's so many great causes. That's a challenge too. My heart goes out to everybody who works with a nonprofit in any way that's trying to help other people. There's so many great organizations out there, and there's so much need. I'm on a board of another nonprofit called Strength and Support that helps veterans and their families with mental health services and addiction services, and that's a phenomenal organization too. They're doing amazing things. There's so many organizations, and I wish that we could all support all of them so that there were never any needs, but there always will be, and that makes it exceptionally difficult, because I can't imagine anybody starts a nonprofit unless they're super, super passionate about something, but it has to be enough of a pull that it gets you through those times when you feel like nobody else gives a shit, that you're the only one that's doing anything. And sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's not true, and it just feels that way. But it's a lot of work and a lot of thankless work, especially in the beginning.
What have you learned about setting up the foundation?
I've learned that it would be a lot easier if I had millions of dollars of my own to give to it. That's for sure. I've learned that there are lots of rules and regulations and government things that you have to do, and that have absolutely nothing to do with the work that you want to do, the work that you want to accomplish. Most of my time is spent in all the minute details of making sure that we're legally compliant and managing the finances and all those things, you know, the shipping of orders and all the things that have nothing to do with why we started this, but are super essential for making it happen. And that's been a huge learning curve for me.
What have you learned about yourself?
Oh, that's a really good question, Julia. Wow, you're good at this. I have learned, I've learned that I can always do more than I think I can, for starters. I always tend to think that certainly the people that make things happen are these wonderful, you know, just charismatic people. And that certainly can be true sometimes, but that's not always the case. Sometimes it's just somebody that is committed enough to just not give up. And I've learned that not only can I not give up on the mission, I can't give up on myself either, which sometimes it would be so much easier too. And I feel like this is Brad's way of making me keep fighting. And that can be sometimes I welcome that and I appreciate it. And sometimes it makes me really angry. Like, you know, damn you, I shouldn't have to be dealing with this. And I just want to, you know, be a hermit and never leave my house and never have to deal with people and never have to talk about my pain and my grief. And but it forces me to have to do that. And for about 15 years after Brad died, I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to see anybody that knew him or was a part of the music scene or anything. I really isolated from all that. That was my way of dealing with it. It wasn't a healthy way, but that just was my way. And then slowly I had to start acknowledging it and dealing with it, but I could still kind of hide a bit. And the foundation is sort of forcing me to not hide from what I'm feeling and or from my grief. And I hate that at times, I really do. But I think ultimately it's good for me.
Have you seen his spirit, or has he come to you in dreams?
I do see him in dreams, yeah, quite a bit. Yeah, some. It's hard. I've always been a very vivid dreamer. I don't dream, I don't remember my dreams all the time. But when I do have dreams, they're super real. And it, whenever I wake up, even if I've been dreaming or not, it takes me a few seconds to figure out where I am, who I am, what day it is. Sometimes I have to look at my phone to see what day it is, and then I have to check my calendar to know what I'm supposed to be like doing. Like, am I supposed to wake up today? What am I supposed to do? I've never been one of those people that just jumps out of bed. I've always been a night person, so waking up has always been difficult for me. But especially when I've had a dream, and especially when I've had a dream with Brad in it, it's very difficult because I wake up and it takes me a few seconds to kind of reason out, wait, is that real? Did that happen? Oh, wait, no, he's not really here. That didn't really happen. So that's difficult. The last dream that I had that he appeared in, I saw him. It was just before a show, and he was coming out to say hi to people. And I just remember thinking that I hadn't seen him in a while, and I had to get to see him. I just had to. And I was just making my way through the crowd, and I wasn't trying to be polite or, you know, let somebody go in front of me. I wasn't shoving people out of the way or anything, but I was being aggressive to get up there because I just knew I had to see him. It had been so long. So I went up and I gave him a hug, and it was so great to see him, and we're talking, and I had this weird sense that something wasn't right, and I couldn't quite figure out what it was, and I couldn't understand why I wasn't just totally stoked to be seeing him because it had been so long. And then I woke up, and it took me a minute to go, why was I feeling like that with him? And then I went, oh, it's because he's not alive. Oh, it's because he's been gone 23 years, and I just started bawling. It was really, it's almost like you have to go through that pain all over again, and that's the hard part. But it's nice. I do like seeing him in dreams because it's good to see him and hear his voice and hug him and have that connection. So I'm always very thankful for that. But it is hard because then it just makes that grief very, very real again.
Wow. So what kind of things make you happy?
My kids make me happy. My kids make me very happy. I have two wonderful boys that they're not perfect, but they're both fighters, and I appreciate that about them. I wish they could have met their uncle. They wish they could have met their uncle. But yeah, my boys make me super happy. The beach makes me super happy. I love being at the water. I love sunsets. It's kind of, you know, I live in California, so that's kind of cliche, but that truly is my happy place. The beach at sunset is my happy place. I don't know. I've had to think about that quite a bit over the last few years about, you know, what is it that I like to do just for me? What is it that makes me happy? And I think I'm still kind of rediscovering that, but definitely my kids and definitely the beach.
Are you a happy person?
I think so. I've struggled with depression and anxiety for a long time. Struggled with depression my whole life. Anxiety for about 15 years or so. So sometimes it can be difficult just to get out of bed in the morning or to leave my house. But I think I am by nature a happy person. I like to be around positive people, and I like to see the brighter side of things, and I am definitely stubborn in the sense that no matter how bad things get, I won't give up. And I think that's really the key for everybody, you know, in life. Like, we all go through shit, we all go through stuff,
The key is just to not give up. Okay, this is a weird question. What's your favorite flower?
That's a great question. Peonies. I love peonies. I think they're fabulous. I don't know why. There's so many different kinds, and I just like the way that they're super fragile and delicate, but there's a lot of parts to them. There's so many petals that they make this, like, this really strong, solid-looking flower that individually the petals would be super, super fragile, but together it makes this really sturdy flower, and I just love that about them.
If you had a TV show, what would it be about?
If I had a TV show, first of all, I'd be the producer. I wouldn't be on the TV show. I'm a very private person, which is why even this interview is extremely challenging for me, but I would definitely be behind the scenes person. That's just kind of who I am. I don't know what it would be about. That's a great question. I do think it would be a comedy, though, because I love laughter. I love laughing, and I think it's good for me. I think it's good for other people. I think it's good for the world in general, because it's really easy to take life too seriously. And I think we constantly need to be reminded that there is good amongst the bad, and there's joy to be had amongst the sadness. And I think that's what makes it all worthwhile.
Well, you've done amazing on the show. I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
Thank you for asking. I don't think so. And I would love, you know, if anybody has $1 million and they'd like a tax write-off, to please get in touch with me. Or even two people with $500,000 each. We are a 501c3, so we have our nonprofit status, and I don't know how it's going to come. I don't know if it's going to be, you know, a couple of people that just want to see this get off the ground and are willing to help it happen right away, or if we're going to have to slog it out for another 5 years, or if some, you know, big musician is going to say, hey, I want to do a benefit show that'll raise the money. I just don't know, and it's just a step of faith, but I'm excited to be a part of it, and I really do feel very privileged to be able to be working to make this happen. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about it.
Oh, absolutely.
I am very proud.
Before you go, yes. I'd like you to say that this is Kelly Noel, and you're listening to Something Wicked Radio.
This is Kelly Noel, and you're listening to Something Wicked Radio.
Stolen from an African land, chased out with a knife, with a face like Bob Marley and a mouth like a motorbike. Oh well, the bars are always open and the time is always right, and if God's good word goes unspoken, the music goes all night, and it goes. If I were Bob Marley, I said, could you be loved? And if I was half pint, I would fall Lord up above. If I was Mike Tyson, I would look for a fight. And if I was a Boomer Rat, I would be staying up all night. If I was a king of rock, I would get stupid dumb. And if Ron Cavalliums, I'd be comfortably numb. Number, you know what I'd do? I'd point that shit straight at the sky and shoot heaven on down for you. Because the bars are always open and the time is always right. And if God's good word goes unspoken, the music goes all night, and it goes. I want a lover, but I can't find the time. I want a reason, but I can't find a rhyme. And I want to start some static, but I can't afford this slander at the ground like I fall off my skateboard. Hey, nowadays, it's clear as you please. Get strapped with protection or strapped with disease. Laughter, it's free. Anytime, just call me. 439-0116. When you die with sublime, you get funky, fresh, getting up here. Stolen from an Africa land, I chased out of the bar. I saw my best friend tonight, so don't push me too far.
it must be sublime. Listen, yellow lover, yet him right on time. We got cricket with the quickness and the baseline. Baseline. Go and raid the town and tell the people the news. Oh, hey, tell them reggae music is on the loose. Where the sun keeps shining, new style and a unique fashion. And good goodbyes, they keep on playing, playing.
Fire one shot for peace equality. Come, come, them a come with the rougher style. Come, come, me not care about your wicked style. Come, come, if you come with the wicked style. Them a fire one shot, pump, pump with the shot. Them a fire two shot, pump, pump, lick a shot. Them a fire three shot, pump, pump, lick a shot. Them not care about me rock.
Rock.
Me no stop people who are launched, them attack me with the armor. Me no stop counter it, me name bigger. Give me come to tell you about this wicked style. Give me come to tell you about this wicked style.
Tell me, smoking crack cocaine better than Simsy. You're popping that shit, you were sick of it. Tweaking every weekend and we just can't take it. Whoa, we don't want plastic.
Took my shame and you took my pride.